Technical difficulties? Resonance 104.4 FM. This is Technical Difficulties on Resonance 104.4 FM. I am your host, Tim Abbott. It's 3:30 in the afternoon here at 144 Borough High Street in London, and just past midnight in Millicent, South Australia, whence you just heard Sarah and Jess Renahan with Sorrow. Sarah and myself both share a journey with the brain condition hydrocephalus, and I'm hoping that by the end of today's show, you will know more about it than you do now. In order to cast some light on it, I'm joined in the studio here by Jill Yaz from the Association for Spina Bifida and Hydrocephalus.
Hello, Tim. Thank you.
Now, the most obvious first question is, what is it?
Hydrocephalus is a condition where fluid that's made in the middle of your brain gets trapped, and it can cause pressure. There's some spaces, we all have spaces in our brains that we don't often aware of, and fluid is made and absorbed. If anything gets trapped or not absorbed, possibly pressure can build up, become trapped, and it can cause some damage to the brain.
Is it common?
It is more common than you'd think for something that a lot of people haven't heard of, Tim. There's about 1 in 1,000 people in this country that have got it for one reason or another.
Okay, so that is the background to it. I'm aware that you can develop it at various stages of life. So just explain what the difference is between it happening after your birth or, say, 15 years into life.
Okay. It can actually happen before birth. There's quite a lot of babies being born with it, developing in the womb with it, being born with it, and having to have it treated straight away. Other childhood things, prematurity. A lot of premature babies have hydrocephalus too. Then later on through our lives, tumours are detected, little cysts in the brain all take up space and they can trap the fluid. And then later on in the life, even so, hopefully, there's head injuries, surgery, any brain surgery can cause it. And in middle years, brain bleeds can also gum up the absorption of it. So it's right the way through, really, the length of your lives.
If you suspect that you're listening to this show and that you think that that sounds like someone you know, it might be yourself. What are the signs?
In children and small babies, you tend to get an increase in the head circumference, and the babies would be quite unwell-looking, not feeding properly, sleepy, lethargic babies who cry a lot, with a head that's increasing in size, with little veins appearing. But later on, once the bones are set, Tim, in your head, then the pressure rises quite quickly if the fluid gets trapped. And that can cause you to become very unwell sometimes over years, but more often over months and weeks, with severe headaches, vomiting, drowsiness, and it can become very serious if it's not treated.
How do you treat it?
The most common way of treating it at the moment is via shunt, which is a thin silicone tube to look at. They look like a piece of cooked spaghetti, about that kind of size, that just passes in through the skull into the ventricles to drain the fluid off, usually into the space around the outside of the bowel, which is called the peritoneal cavity. But it can end up in other places where it can drain the fluid off, and the body just deals with it naturally, just absorbs it, returns it back into the bloodstream.
For those of us listening to the show, and I'll include myself in this, who've been diagnosed with it and been treated for it, what do you do afterwards, and what's the long-term coping strategy?
Okay. I think once people have had a shunt, especially in their adult lives, it can be very difficult for people to get used to the idea that you need this piece of silicone tubing to stay alive. And people can feel quite depressed and angry about that for a while. But I think in the long term, it's actually managing, finding out how does your body cope with it? You know, are there things, if you overdo it, do you get headachy? Do you need to drink more, eat a little bit more frequently? And just maybe just to just pace your life a little bit. But it's learning what feels right for your body. Sometimes people with hydrocephalus get a lot of headaches, even if their shunt is working completely fine. And that can be managed. Take specialist advice on that. Go to get yourself referred to a headache clinic or something.
Is it similar then to managing a traumatic brain injury then?
Traumatic brain injuries, yeah, I think it probably is. I mean, it might have effects on the way your brain does things. The hydrocephalus can affect your memory, for example. So memory and just how you find things, the way you organise your thing. Just have a little sit down and think about how do you do things, what are going to help. So sometimes people find they get very frustrated if they can't remember things. And they just keep on trying to remember things and they can't. So just try and find, if I can't remember, what can I do? How can I reach the same end result and function and live my life? Maybe I need to do something slightly differently to other people, but what might that be? Talk through with friends and relatives about how they perceive and to see if they've got any suggestions. using things like email for reminders, texts, phone alarms, those sorts of things, just to remind you. But I think as well, be mindful that, you know, sometimes shunts do go wrong, and just to let people, some people close to you, know to look out for some of the signs that you might be coming a bit unwell and need some treatment, because you might not recognise it yourself.
And your charity, you actually operate you print and distribute alert cards.
We do, yes, they're very popular.
What do they say, and how do people get hold of them?
People can get hold of them via our national office, which the website, which is www.asbar.org. Have a look on there. You can order them from our national office. The little cards and the information that is on there includes what kind of shunt you've got, who your neurosurgeon is, what your hospital numbers are, everything that you might need, information that a centre might need to get information about you should you become very ill very quickly, and you might not be in a position to be able to tell them by then. We also do a shunt passport as well, which is shunt information in holiday languages as well, that you can get to make sure that you don't have any trouble at airports.
Aha, yeah. Does it cause problems with security checks? I mean, it's made out of silicon, so I don't expect it would trigger a metal detector.
Ordinary ones don't, but there are some shunts where a valve is controlled by a little magnetic device and it can be changed. And sometimes, every now and again, these programmable shunts, the magnet can get changed by the security gates. So if you're ever looking for excuse not to go through a knife arch, there it is.
Yeah, that sounds so what happens then?
You take some information saying that it's not a good idea. If it says these gates are not a good idea if you've got a pacemaker, then you should avoid them as well. But only for some people with these programmable shunts, and they all know who they are as well. But the shunts are getting better. It doesn't often happen. It's just a precaution.
I remember that I used to go through arches with my glasses on and have them set off, and they don't anymore. So okay. I think, yeah, the sensitivity is getting better. So leaving aside the worrying prospect of a metal detector setting off your programmable shunt, if you have... I'll rephrase that. If you think that you're not well, or you're listening to this again and you think someone in your family who has that history, has hydrocephalus and has had a shunt, that something's wrong, what are the signs of malfunction in the shunt?
The signs of malfunction, especially in adults, would be quite a rapid deterioration for most people in how conscious they are. Sometimes people get headaches, sometimes they don't, sometimes they vomit, sometimes they don't. But over a period of time, people with shunt blockages that are going to make them ill will become quite drowsy and start losing consciousness. And that's the time to really act, because for most people whose shunts are taking all the fluid out of their heads, you've really got about a 4-hour window before you should get to your neurosurgeon. But for a lot of people, again, sort of especially people who have had shunts in for, you know, a couple of decades, sometimes the body finds its own way of dealing with the fluid without the shunt. So sometimes, you know, even if your shunt isn't actually working and it's become if you find it on an X-ray and it's become disconnected, but if you're all right, then everything is all right.
I've heard people have said that to me in examinations, and I had mine put in 1984 when I was two. And I'm now 29, and I've had one operation to put it in and never had a revision. And I suspect, and some neurosurgeons have said this to me, that the body has adapted around the situation. So what do you do in that circumstance? You go straight to a hospital.
If you're unwell, yes, you should go. If you can get to your neurosurgical unit safely and quickly, which in London is a bit of an issue with the traffic and everything, most people are better off, unless they've been told otherwise, to go to their local hospital with some information about their shunt and say, I suspect there's a shunt blockage. Phone your neurosurgery centre up before you go, so they know that you're unwell and wanting attention, because sometimes they have to jig the accident emergency department along to get you transferred. But that's really what they should do if you suspect that it's an acute problem.
And it's probably suitable for a program like this, discussing brain impairment, that I couldn't structure a sentence properly there. And I apologise to anyone who heard that sentence who was offended, but I repeat, I know what this condition is and have it. You're listening to Technical Difficulties. This is Resonance 104.4 FM. We are discussing hydrocephalus, which is not uncommon, is an expression I've heard.
Not uncommon.
But not very well known. How common is it statistically, and is there a specific demographic that it hits particularly, or is it across everyone?
I think probably about half of people with the condition have got it by the time they're a few months old, I think. But at the moment, there's about 15,000 people in the country who've got shunts as a total. And they do about 3,500 to 4,000 shunt operations a year. So it's quite a lot. It's half of all children's neurosurgery is shunt-related or hydrocephalus-related.
And is it... What is the rate of failure then? I was saying... I'll explain to the listeners. I was talking about this before as possibly the most common anxiety-provoking thing in my healthcare life is the fact that I have this thing in my head and I have no idea what the failure rate is. Mm-hmm. And I know that that is quite a common concern amongst other people with hydro. So what are the statistics on that?
The statistics on that, they're quite interesting because if shunts are going to go wrong, statistically they've got much higher chance of going wrong in the first 6 months. As they're draining out fluid, your brain changes shape. Little bits of tissue can get clogged up in it as that happens. So I think 3/4 of any shunt failures happen in that first 6 months. Infection used to be a part of the reason why they went wrong, which only happens in the very early weeks of a shunt. But we've got shunts now with antibiotics impregnated into the silicone, uh-huh. which is called Bactisil, which is a real breakthrough for that. Some people are unlucky and they have to have revision after revision, but that's mostly children. And I think for the statistics is that after 5 years in children, 56% of shunts will still be surviving. And for adults, there's a 32% failure rate in the first 5 years. And then after that, it's a steady about 5% every year that do fail and need to be replaced. So, you know, though it causes a lot of anxiety, I think people do need to take it seriously. And in my experience, it doesn't matter how long you've had a shunt, you can never say it'll never pack up or you don't need it anymore. And we have had a few cases where people have had their fingers burnt, you know, by not taking that. Oh, I've had it since I was 3 months old and I'm 30 now, and then suddenly it's gone. You always need to have it in the back of your mind that it could be a problem. But I think the statistics, they're not that unreliable. They very rarely go wrong in themselves. It's usually tissue blocking up or something blocking them up. Part of your body will be blocking them up. But they actually the valves that control the flow are very reliable. It's not as bad as the press gets, but there are a few unlucky people who have had, you know, multiple revisions over their lives, 40 or 50, which is very sad.
I think 30% is quite a high percentage, though, for something to fail.
Over 5 years, and but 3/4 of those will be in the first 6 months. So, you know, they're quite reliable. But as a rate after that, after the first year, it's about 5% a year.
Is it sort of symptomatic of complicated medical procedures in general? Do you think it's more there's more failure and more problems in less developed countries with less developed healthcare systems?
Oh, the access to this kind of surgery in the developing world is very poor, and it's a matter of concern. There are some doctors that are pioneering some procedures for use, for example, in Africa, where people won't be able to get back to a neurosurgical centre, something that's permanent. But it's a big problem, and we do have very good facilities in this country.
Because infrastructure, I mean, I remember thinking this before, that there are circumstances where the transport network is vital for you to be able to actually still be alive. If it's a four-hour window, then being 4 hours from a hospital is quite a challenge in quite a lot of places. And you're right that there's just not... Is it the case that you've got a finite number of experts as well, and so you've got to get to one of those people? It's not like you can just turn up.
Oh, you can't just turn up anywhere. Yeah. You turn up at your GP and say, right.
Yeah, I need a shunt revision, please. Yeah.
Yeah.
ASBA is the UK institution. So do you link up with other institutions to share advice on that and push for advances?
There is an international federation. It's called IF Global. It's called that. It's a confederation of like-minded organisations going all over the world, and they'll be encouraged to, especially in the developing world, for people to get together to push to find ways of getting treatments and getting the conditions recognised. And I did meet a lady in Great Ormond Street from, I think she was from Nigeria, and she was a journalist. Her son had hydrocephalus, and she was going to go and use a radio station because she said in the villages, everyone's got a radio if you haven't got anything else. And she said she was going to use it to actually get the message out that it was treatable, you know, and do take, because, you know, sadly, a lot of countries, even some of the poorer countries in Europe, you know, the babies will die just because either people don't know that it's treatable or they haven't got access to that treatment.
I mean, we were discussing this before, that the dynamics of the condition, if in quite a lot of situations, if you say a person has too much of a fluid in their body, then they tap a hole and drain it out. I'll ask the question, why is that not something you would do with hydrocephalus?
Well, the shunt more or less does that. You are making a hole into the cavity where the fluid's getting trapped, and you're just draining it. But you're just draining it in a closed way. If you just made a hole, you would have to stop bacteria getting in. You would have to be able to control the fluid getting in. Otherwise, your head would just collapse because the fluid is under some pressure. So, but at the most, it's bacteria. If you had that, you would get meningitis and encephalitis, and you'd become very ill.
And that presumably is an issue in areas where there's not the developed healthcare system, that they have to resolve the issue within that window, or the person will die. But they might not have the infrastructure to install the shunt.
I think so, and it's just even getting the message out that it's a treatable condition. And in a lot of places in Africa, the most common cause is infection in the babies, either before birth or during birth, and they're usually very sick babies in the first place.
Yeah, and it's not easy to operate on a child that's already ill.
No, and the outcomes tend to be less good, and it's all very sad. I'm just glad that we've got something, you know, in this country that can benefit people.
I'll say briefly, actually, I was, it's not evident right now, I was saying to Jill before that my hair's longer than it has been at some times, but I posted a photograph online of what the scar on my head normally looks like when my hair is short. And I've got to be honest, Sarah Renahan's scar beats mine hands down. She even had a mohawk cut onto her hair to illustrate, to raise money to illustrate it.
Oh,
and
wow.
Given where the scar is, and that is on one side of the head, that means it's very, very visible. A fantastic piece of awareness raising. I'd just like to get into the association and your background as an institution and what you're going to be doing going on.
Oh, right, OK. Well, the most exciting thing that we're going to be doing, which I have to mention now before I get onto the background, is we're going to be coming out next month as SHINE, which stands for Spina Bifida Hydrocephalus Information Network and Equality. And going to raise our profile so that more people do find out about the conditions, but more people can come, network with each other and gain that support that you can only really get from people who have had similar experiences to yourselves. We're going to be encouraging that. But the organisation really grew up, I think, in the 1960s from groups of parents whose children, having had the benefit of a very new treatment for the hydrocephalus, were the first ones to survive in any numbers, and they were being left in the 1960s with no support to cope with their children's conditions or disabilities and things that we now take for granted through the hard fights of a lot of people with disabilities that they didn't have, the things that they had to fight for and campaign for and get the information themselves. But we've grown up really from them.
And the association has two conditions in its title, and they both translate into the new institution as well, Spina Bifida and Hydrocephalus. Now, we've spoken quite a lot about hydrocephalus. Yeah. What is Spina Bifida and why does it relate to hydrocephalus?
Right, OK. Spina Bifida is a condition that affects the development of the spinal cord in the back, and that happens right the way at the very beginning of the pregnancy, and can cause a lot of significant physical disabilities, where hydrocephalus can affect mostly the way you learn, remember, and those things. But spina bifida can affect the way your movement, mobility, your skin, can affect your bladder and bowel function, all lots of different things. But the association between the two conditions is that most people with open forms of spina bifida also have hydrocephalus. So there was a big group of people who came with the two conditions, and it's actually very difficult. One has a knock-on effect on the other. If you've got physical impairment, there might be more things that you have to do to care for yourself properly, remember to do, to keep healthy. And if your memory is affected, then that might be harder. So that's how the two things grew. But lots of people have got spina bifida on its own. That's fine. Lots of people have got hydrocephalus on its own, and that's fine too.
So are you doing several things at once here?
You are, aren't you?
Yes, well, you know, the joys of self-operating, as they call it in the business. So I wonder, yeah, it's always useful in these circumstances to look forward to. We've covered how things have progressed. So what would you wish to be going forward? What is your target for SHINE? What would you hope to see?
I'd hope to see a big raising of an awareness of the two conditions, so that people, you know, for children going through school, more people are aware of how the people might be affected, a lot more sensitive handling, you know, that people who look like other people, in inverted commas, there are lots of hidden disabilities there, and I'd like everybody to be having access to the support that they need to thrive and do well and succeed. I'd also like, we've got a Go Folic campaign as well to encourage women of childbearing ages to actually take folic acid. Lots of people know they're meant to be taking it, but it can help to prevent your pregnancy being affected by spina bifida. So I'd just like to flag that up.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for joining us, Jill Yaz, from the Association for Spina Bifida and Hydrocephalus, soon to be SHINE. Can currently be found online at www.asbah.org.
Yes.
Thank you for listening. Sarah Renahan's site is projectbraindrain.org. This show will be podcast at the end of the day. Stay tuned to The Art of Listening. The Clear Spot is next. Wear your scars with pride. And remember, we all have technical difficulties. See you next week.